Senate will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 3rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 72, County Jails, Release of Information, Ayes 57, Noes 3. House Bill Number 115, DUI Penalties, Ayes 53, Noes 7. House Bill Number 160, Constituent Services Allowance, Ayes 60. House Bill 243, District Attorney Salary, Ayes 58, Noes 1, Conflict 1. House Bill 251, Trust, Retirement Funds Accounting, Ayes 60. February the 3rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 33, Expanded Opportunity Pilot Program, Ayes 47, Noes 13. House Bill Number 38, Fiscal Year for Governmental Entities, Ayes 58, Noes 2. House Bill Number 156, Energy Performance Contracting 2, Ayes 49, Noes 10, Conflict 1. House Bill Number 195, Real Estate Act Amendments, Ayes 60. House Bill Number 225, Bighorn Sheep and Ewe Lamb Licenses, Ayes 58, Noes 2. House Bill Number 241, Criminal Background Checks Retirement System, Ayes 59, Noes 1. And House Bill Number 31, Smoking in Enclosed Public Places, Ayes 31, Noes 29. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 141, first reading of that bill.
House Bill Number 141, sponsored by Representative Gingery. Impaired Driving Prevention Amendments, an act relating to driving under the influence. Passed the House on third reading in an amended form. Ayes 49, noes 10, excused 1.
House Bill 141 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 72, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill Number 72, sponsored by Representative Berger. County Jails, Release of Information, and Act Relating to County Jails. Passed the House on third reading, Ayes 57, Noes 3.
House Bill 72 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 243, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 243, sponsored by Representative Cohey, District Attorney's Salary. And Act Relating to District Attorneys, passed the House on third reading, Ayes 58, Noes 1, Conflict 1.
House Bill 243 is referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, House Bill 9, first reading of the House bill.
House Joint Resolution 9, Wind Energy, sponsored by Representative Simpson. A joint resolution to encourage county officials to take a proactive approach to the burgeoning wind energy resource development. Passed the House on third reading, Ayes 53, Noes 7.
House Joint Resolution 9 is referred to Committee Number 3, Committee Number 7, Corporations. House Bill 113, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 113, sponsored by Representative Buchanan, Careless Driving, an act relating to the regulation of traffic. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 53, noes 7.
House Bill 113 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 115, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 115, sponsored by Representative Mercer, DUI Penalties, an act relating to driving while under the influence. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 53, noes 7.
House Bill 115 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. House Bill 251, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 251, sponsored by Representative Gingery, Trust, Retirement Funds Accounting, and Act Relating to Trusts. Pass the House, ayes 60.
House Bill 251 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. House Bill 160, first reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 160, sponsored by Representative Landon, Constituent Service Allowance, an act relating to the legislature. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 60.
House Bill 160 is referred to Committee Number 12, Rules. Reports from standing committees.
February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 108, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 138, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 146, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 49, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Coe, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Fladeren, Senator Coe, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 118, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 134, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Landon, Von Fladeren. No, Senator Guy, Senator Von Fladeren, Chairman. February the 2nd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 135, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 2nd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 107, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Flader, and Senator Von Flader, and Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 3, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, and Johnson. No, Senator Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 135, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Coe, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman. Am I okay? February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 93, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Coe, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 88, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Coe, and Sessions. No, Senators Jennings. Excuse, Senator Dockstader. Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 207, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Coe, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 131, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Coe, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Flatern, Senator Co-Chairman.
Considerations of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business, consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Senator Johnson.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 24. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 24, Healthcare Reform Demonstration Project, sponsored by the Labor Committee, an act relating to health insurance. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. It reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, and Nicholas. No, Senators Peterson and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee of the whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate file 24 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate file 24, standing committee amendment number 1, page 6, line 5.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, let me say just a few words about the bill before I go to the standing committee amendment. The first question I think you need to ask on any bill is why do we do it and why do we need to do it now? There's two reasons on this bill. First, and this is the basic health care reform demonstration project bill. I think our constituents, Mr. Chairman, are demanding action in this area. Certainly it was my experience going door-to-door in the campaign this last year that when I asked people, and I did, about what their priorities were for what the state ought to do, for the first time in my memory, health care came out on top, ahead of education, as their people's number one priority. Minority of them were concerned about their ability to get a physician at all. That's a different subject. But most of them were concerned about the high cost of health care, the unavailability of affordable health insurance, didn't have health insurance. That whole set of issues. And this bill is in that area. So it's legislation that we need to respond to one of the deep concerns that our constituents have right now. And all the polling data I've seen tells me the same things what I learned going door to door and talking to people, that this is an area that people are demanding action. Second, it does look like the feds are going to do major things in the healthcare area. Now, it's a little hard to predict exactly what they're going to do. And some of the things they're talking about doing in the stimulus plan, some of them we better hope they don't do because they could be an absolute disaster for Wyoming. There's a couple things if they might do, we might be down here suddenly spending a lot of money we don't have just to preserve a basic health care system in this state. This bill won't help with that part. But the things it looks like they most likely are to do in a health care reform, a thought-out health care coverage reform, thought out as much as Washington ever thinks anything out, are that, at least what I hear, is that they're looking at the Massachusetts state model and looking at a federal state program to ensure the people who are working but can't afford health insurance, of which there's an increasing number. And if they do that, we need to be ready to respond. What scale they do it on, I think, will depend on whether they can figure out a way that they can get agreement on to finance it. If they can figure out how to finance it, they're talking to going to 400% of federal poverty, which would cover most of our population. If they can't figure out a way to finance it, they'll still do something, but I think it'll be on a smaller scale, a more reasonable scale, if you will. In any event, I think it's important that we be prepared to react to such a federal initiative. In the welfare reform, Mr. Chairman, those of you who may recall that, we had the advantage, we had done pilot programs for several years, then we actually enacted our welfare reform before the feds did. And the advantage those pilot programs and that enactment gave us was we had a pretty good idea of what we wanted to do. So when the feds enacted theirs, we were able to say, okay, how can we do what we want to do given their framework? And we were able to work out a very successful plan. Wyoming has led the nation as the most successful effort to deal with the welfare and the welfare reform. We have reduced our caseloads by more than anybody else, and it's been better for all concerned. I think part of the reason we need to get started on this health reform is to put ourselves in the same position in that regard. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, is that in the past, when Washington has done things in the health area in Medicaid, they've tended to be pretty prescriptive as to what we can and can't do. But states that have already gotten started in both Medicaid and then again in the kid care program have been grandfathered in for the things they're already doing. And so we need to get started, because some of the things we want to do to keep our costs within reason may not be things that Washington will approve of, but might be willing to grandfather. So it's important in that respect. Mr. Chairman, the essence of this bill, it was worked out between our joint committee and the governor's office, is that we are trying to find a way to take advantage of the known fact, and we've discussed it here several times, that in our healthcare system, there's a lot of medically unnecessary care. Take advantage of that to come up with a system that can control healthcare costs so that we can sustain and financially afford any reform that we make. And that's what this bill is all about. We're experimenting with some of those techniques. Chairman, having said that, let's go to the Standing Committee Amendment. And I'll take the Senate through that briefly. We have some refinements in the design, including in the section on page 8, line 3 in the medical home. We're adding some language that lets us send patients outside the medical home if there's another provider that more effectively or more economically you can get the needed services from. For example, think colonoscopy. That would not typically be done by the kind of primary care providers who provide the medical home. That would be an example one where you go outside. We did find, after listening, our committee listened, Mr. Chairman, to Dr. Hank Gardner, who developed the basic cost controls that we're looking for here, and we discovered in one of them the system on the team on preventive services, clinical prevention team, that he had there was a priority there we had not included, and that is that he's having this team work with some of the people who are most at risk of getting into the very expensive category and trying to help them take personal steps to avoid those serious health problems. And that seems to be effective. So we added that. And that's the page 8, line 22 reference. We added that in. Mr. Chairman, the next one of substance is we're experimenting here with using, we call them personal health account. They're like a health savings account, but they can be different because you don't have to worry about income taxes with these populations, so you don't have to have all the bells and whistles that you do for an IRS-qualified health savings account. Using them with a low-income population, you have to worry. So what happens if they get sick in the first month or two before the accounts build up enough? And this allows us to advance money under those circumstances and get it paid back over time. That's what it's lines 20 and 20 through 26 of the first page of the amendment. That's what that's about. The next standard item is on page 1, lines 30 of the amendment and following. We had a presentation from the governor's office on what the state employees' health insurance was doing and putting incentives in to motivate people to come get their preventive care. Positive incentives seems to be working for the state employees. We added this as an option to one of the things we can do in our benefit design for this program. because, Mr. Chairman, authorizing all kinds of preventive services doesn't do you any good unless the individual you're offering them to actually come and take advantage of it. So that's what that's for. On page 15, line 20, the committee felt we had a 20-hour-a-week work requirement for people who are going to be eligible for this program. Committee decided we didn't need to apply that to their spouses. There'd be some circumstances where that wouldn't be appropriate, say when they had young kids. So the committee made that an exemption. We want to make sure we can, we get both spouses, because we think, particularly with the preventive things, that the mutual reinforcement of the family setting will be useful. Then page 16, after line 8, most of this is a correction of a drafting error. You have to have a provision in one of these programs where you review the eligibility periodically and disenroll people who've ceased to be eligible because they're earning too much. You know, we're under the necessary support for the poor restriction of our Constitution. That was explained to the Joint Committee, but it was omitted in the drafting through an error. This puts that paragraph back in and, frankly, adds an exception or two where the administrator can waive the work requirement due to a shortage of jobs, or if we need more stability in our enrollment so we can do our evaluation better. But that's a basic requirement that was in the original draft and got omitted in the process. Page 18, lines 11 through 16, and that we're in this in the evaluation section. We're saying if we're going to compare it with other government programs to see if it's saving cost, we've got to look at the government programs both with the reimbursement rates they do pay and if they paid a full cost reimbursement. So we're comparing apples to apples. And that's what that does. And then, Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee, Committee 10, went and cut the budget back. It came in at $5,100,000. We repriced it. And what happened was we priced it initially based on just selling family coverage. And then we did two things in drafting the final interim bill that, because we could see what was happening to us financially, we said, spouses will count against the 500-person limit in the first year. So that reduced the demand for the cost of having extra people due to family coverage. And we're going to send all the children involved to Medicare or to our child health insurance program, because with our eligibilities, they're all going to be eligible for that anyhow. So we went to analyzing it on the basis of individual coverage, and we were able to sharpen our pencils and reduce the appropriation. So that's what that does. Mr. Chairman, that's the Standing Committee Amendment. I'd be happy to answer questions in the Standing Committee Amendment.
Discussion? Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question with regards to page, the portion of the amendment, page 16, line 8, we talk about the participants' eligibility. And I assume that means, of course, that their income has to be less than 250% of the federal poverty level. And I'm just wondering, I mean, where those are at now. They change as the years have gone on. And is that that's the first question. The second is that across the board for individual, like 250% for a family of two or less than 250% for a family of four? Is it across the board, or are we using just have we at all narrowed that field at all?
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, now, first in the eligibility, let me make it clear that initial eligibility is at 200% of federal poverty. And then we don't kick you off the program till you get to 250, so that there is not a cliff but some room, an incentive for people to improve their economic situation before they have to leave. Frankly, the other thing is that it is set at a percent of federal poverty, and that does vary by family size. And, Mr. Chairman, I left my copy of the federal poverty guidelines up in the committee room. I think maybe the senator now has one and could read us, if he would, what 250% or what 200% of federal poverty actually is.
Senator Ross?
Percent of family of federal poverty level for family size of one is 20,800. For family size of two, it's 28,000. Family size of three, it's 35,200. Family size of four is 42,400. Family of five is 49,600. Family of six is $56,800. Family of seven is $64,000, and a family of eight is $71,200.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And you can figure the 250%. They don't quite go up mathematically, but it comes close.
Further discussion, Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the sponsor, on page 16, and it continues on page 17, these numbers that start at 500 and continue on to 3,000, could you give us some background on how you settled on those numbers? Is that going to be adequate with our changing economy? And just where did you come from on those numbers?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let's dispose of the Standing Committee Amendment, and then I'll answer that question because it relates to the bill.
Further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment number one. Further discussion. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number one to Senate File 24, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number one to Senate File 24 has passed. Back on the bill, Senator Scott, and when do you let me know when you think we should move over to Standing Committee Amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we do Standing Committee Amendment number two right now, and then we'll come back to the bill.
Okay, the reading clerk will read the amendment.
Senate File 24, Standing Committee Amendment number two, page 23, line 5.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment number two to Senate File 24. This maintains the funding at the level that came out of the first committee, but does a fund switch so the dollars come out of the tobacco funds. And we made an inquiry. We do have sufficient tobacco funds to pay for this for this year.
Further discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we also heard about this possibility in Committee 10, although we left it to the Appropriations Committee on the grounds that they knew what they were doing in this area, and we didn't. But we did have discussion that we could do this and still maintain the current level of our anti-tobacco programs.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 2, to Senate File 24, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to Senate File 24 has passed. Back on the bill, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me take us through the bill just briefly, and I can go into more detail in any section any member wants. Let me answer the question that was asked first. The way the bill is structured, we will start with 500 enrollees. And then on July 1st, 2010, we would go up by another 2,500 to a total of 3,000. The reason for that design is that, Mr. Chairman, we're doing enough things that are novel in the benefit design here. The only thing I will absolutely guarantee to the Senate is that we will get some of the details wrong the first time we try it, we'll have to back up and do something a little differently to achieve what we're seeking to. And we won't know that until we try it with real people. But we wanted to try it with a relatively small number, keep the expense down, try it with a small number so that we could find those problems and fix them before we took it to a much broader level. Now, the 3,000 is intended to give us enough people to find out, will it really control the costs? Will it get adequate insurance and save money? It's probably, Mr. Chairman, as one of the insurance folks who did help us work on this said, you probably don't have enough people in the whole state of Wyoming to get an absolute test on that. But with 3,000, you can get a pretty good idea. 3,000 in enough time. That's the design. Another element of that design is very important. Look at that July 1, 2010 date. That's the start of the next biennium. So if we discover that the price of gas, natural gas went down instead of up, and that we have financial troubles next time, well, we can put that 2010 date off very easily next year. We just don't appropriate the money to go that far, and we see where we are. That's done on purpose, knowing the nature of Wyoming's finances. So that's an additional precaution. Will it solve our entire problem? No, sir, it will not. But first, we have to figure out, can we do it in a way that we can sustain any reform that we ultimately do? Any reform that we ultimately do will have to take into account what the feds do in the next year or so. I think after the next year or so, they won't do anything radical because they've got so many other problems that are going to overwhelm them coming out of the Medicare program. But by next year, we'll be able to mesh whatever we do with whatever requirements we get out of the federal government. So, no, we won't be able to solve, even at that level, all the problems. We're talking about 18% or so of our total population being without health insurance, and that's concentrated in the working age population because almost all children are in either Medicaid or SCHIP or wealthy enough so they're privately covered, and all seniors have Medicare, with very little exception. So we're concentrated, maybe a third of our working age population lacks health insurance. And that's where we're going to be concentrating, and those numbers are obviously bigger than 3,000. So our options are open in the future, but that's our estimate of how many we'll need to test, do we really save money here? And, you know, it's a twofold test. Do you save money? You can always save money by cutting back the benefits enough. You do an adequate job of health insurance and save money. That's the real test. Mr. Chairman, let me go through the heart of this bill is in the specific cost controls. And let me just run the Senate through those briefly. Preventive services, you can see those on page 5, line 20, page 7, line, I think it's 9 and following. Plain vanilla, every insurance contractor, most of them in the private sector, do some of this. Preventive services that come at no charge to the insured. What we're doing here that's different is we're going to have a little broader definition, including preventive services, some of the primary care visits, because we really think those are preventive. That's what good doctors' figures show, and includes probably some of the maintenance drugs like blood pressure drugs that really prevent people from getting in trouble later. Second, medical home concept. This is one that did not come from the governor's consultant, but rather came from the Health Care Commission. It's a very common feature in health reform efforts all over the country. You can look it up. Basically, it's encouraging people to get a medical home with their primary care provider. We've got some exceptions in there, including some language that says to the extent practical. Reason for that is, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll get enough primary providers in our initial test of 500. Beyond that, we're going to have trouble. because the state is desperately short of primary care providers. That's what our database shows. That's what I find going and talking to my constituents. I met an awful lot of them who couldn't find a doctor. We got a real problem, and it's a national problem. Wyoming, like many of these problems, has this one worse than the rest of the country, but it's a national shortage. That's going to be a difficulty long term, but we want to try it, because if we can successfully try it and pay the providers more for providing the service, which we'll have to do to get it, then you get a more attractive climate for the providers to come in. It's a chicken and egg kind of proposition. A second, or third, I guess, we're going to use deductibles and copayments. You can see those, page 5, line 15, page 11, line 7. The thing that we're doing is different. Again, pretty standard insurance, Mr. Chairman. But we're saying let's have a lower copayment for the primary care services, because they're more likely to be effective and prevent worse troubles, and a higher payment for the surgical and the specialty care, which is more likely to be the high cost, so that people are motivated to not go there unless they really need to. Next item, Mr. Chairman, personal health account. You can see that. It's on page 9, I believe. This, if you're going to use with a low-income population, as we're proposing to, deductibles and copayments, you got to have a way for them to pay it. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. So what we're proposing to do is use something that looks very much like a health savings account and contribute to it, be it contributions from the individual participant and from the state, on a sliding scale according to income, which is something we're used to doing. This is the place, as far as I know, Mr. Chairman, nobody else has tried this approach with a low-income population. The trick is to get one that you don't have to put too much money into, otherwise it removes your cost savings, that the participants look at as if it were their own money and are motivated to conserve it, so they can use it for other things that they need in the health area that aren't covered. And I suspect this is the one we're most likely to have to make some mid-course corrections and adjustments in, because this we are pioneering in this particular respect. I think it's likely to work. Final item is the preventive services team, page 8, line 11 and following in particular. Two functions. One, when you think of your cost structure in healthcare, 50% of your cost comes out of somewhere between 2 and 3% of your insureds. And that 50% comes in chunks of 25,000 or more. They had something major go wrong, and they needed a lot of services. Okay, if you're going to control your healthcare costs, those things are outside the motivations of deductibles and copayments and personal health accounts. They're big. You've blown past all that kind of conventional cost control. Your preventive services help you from getting there, so they're helpful here. But you need something else, and this is the something else. It would be a team of ideally an advanced nurse practitioner and a pharmacist. The pharmacist, because polypharmacy is often an issue, you know, multiple interacting prescriptions that get you in trouble. And their first charge would be to make sure the individual gets what they need. Second is to avoid the health care that is positively harmful, and there is a fair amount. Unnecessary procedures, unnecessary exposure to ionizing radiation, as in an unnecessary CAT scan, those things all carry some risk, and you want to avoid them if they are unnecessary. And then their third charge is try to control the costs. State has been doing that with this team on a smaller scale. We heard about it in committee. Looks like it's working, but that's a key component of the cost controls. In terms of the organization here, we've used a very standard technique that we've used we used it for child health, we used it for the uninsurable pool, we used it for small group. You have a benefits design committee. We've actually given them a good deal more guidance here than we normally do. And then we're going to administer this through the Wyoming uninsurable pool, the so-called WHIP pool. It's an ongoing organization. We don't have to reinvent the organizational wheel. It's used to dealing with insurance-like products, which this is. And then we're going to ask the Department of Health to do the evaluation. So we've got a separate evaluator who doesn't have a stake in the outcome looking at it, and I think that's good policy. We've talked about the initial population size. Evaluation part, I do commend there's a section on it. We've talked about the eligibilities, the section on the evaluation. That's key, and will be key particularly when we go to the larger numbers. That's found on page 17 and following. We did amend it in the Standing Committee Amendment. But that, I think, tells people basically what we're looking for. Is it adequate insurance? Does it keep the costs under control? Mr. Chairman, that's a quick run through the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions on the bill? Senator Ross.
Question with regards to those participants. Where are they going to come from? Are they going to be centered more here in Cheyenne because all of this stuff is here in Cheyenne? I mean, is it going to be spread out? How do we know where they're going to be and what the criteria will be for them?
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, the basic answer to that, if you look on page 14 and 15 of the bill in the eligibility section, income at time of enrollment not to exceed 200% of federal poverty, working at least 20 hours a week or equivalent. Priority in enrollment starting on top of page 15. First, individuals completed a vocational readiness work preparation program through the Department of Workforce Services, et cetera. That's where the first 500 we think are going to come from, almost entirely. And I think there may be some concentration of them in this corner of the state. Individual been participants in the Medicaid program or other state assistance become ineligible for that program due to increased earnings. That's your second priority. We may get into that a little in the first year, but mostly that'll be when we try to expand. And actually, with the figures that Dr. Gardner showed us in committee as to how much some of these state programs were costing compared to what a private program like this should cost, we may come back and ask you to authorize some incentives to get people off those state programs and into this, because it'll be cheaper for us if we can get it working right. Third priority, individuals whose children are enrolled in Medicaid or child health insurance program. Seeking to get those individuals covered. They've already passed a means test. That's where we'll go for the larger numbers. And then we do seek to get a geographic distribution, and I'm looking for the provision. We're wanting to have enough so that we get a test within looking at both communities where you've got a federal community health center to participate and communities where you don't, and we're looking to get a geographic distribution spread, and I'm sorry I can't pick that out of the bill right now, but it's in there. And so we do, when we expand off the 500, then you're going to get a pretty good distribution statewide.
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of things have happened that I want to ask a question about this and the availability of doctors. I have a friend who they talked into coming back out of retirement to go to Casper to fill a need. She came from the state of Washington back to Casper and got quite ill with a respiratory infection and things about 3 weeks ago. She is on Medicare, and she has a supplemental insurance. She could not get a doctor to take her. There were signs on the door of two of the clinics up there that said, we do not take Medicare patients. And the secretary called innumerable people. Finally ended up, and she said it was a wonderful clinic. Had a very fine doctor that finally was able to give her some help. But my question is, I find that kind of astounding that, you know, Medicare, I mean, I suppose it doesn't maybe pay as much as they would like, but I know people with supplemental insurances that you can prove you have, then you get another extra boost. She even offered to pay cash. They won't take cash. So my question in with this is, are they going to have the kind of care they need from a doctor that will help and will deal with this low-cost patient? Because that's what we're trying to do. I guess that's my question.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and the good senator has put her finger on one of the major problems we have in the health care area in the state of Wyoming. We don't have enough providers. We just straight don't. We've got a number of reasons for it. Partly economic, partly our tort system. There's a number of reasons. For this program, the key is going to be the primary care providers, and they're what's shortest. That's an advantage of the medical home concept here. We're planning, and we're going to set the reimbursement for that, directly, not depending on what they're already charging for something. We're planning to pay enough to get it. And frankly, we think from our primary care population, both in the community health centers and outside them, there's enough interest in that concept so they will be willing to take on the initial dose of these. These people are getting health care by and large somehow. So we do think that we will be able to solve that problem. But it, as we go to the larger numbers, it's going to be a problem because it's going to be a problem for every citizen in the state of Wyoming. And frankly, I think we're headed for another crisis, and we're going to have to think what we're going to do about it. This program will help that by making it a little more attractive for the primary care doctors because of the medical home concept, particularly if, as we hope, some of the private insurances start to imitate that. And we set a little higher reimbursement for that, so the primary care doctors are motivated to do it. That's going to be key. But in the future, that's going to be a problem, and it won't be a problem for this program. It's going to be a problem for all of us.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple of questions. First, on the preventive services, if this is a pilot or a demonstration project, are there any limited to the services, or just everything that comes along will qualify? And then my second question would go more on to the participant. If somebody is not participating in any government program and struggling along on a low income, are they eligible?
Senator Scott.
Okay. On the first question, the preventive services, they should be evidence-based. And I'm looking, I think we used that language. And it's described as to be specified in the benefit designed to achieve the objectives of this article. And then the page 7, this meant to promote better health, identify chronic disease. Preventive services shall include cost-effective, evidence-based, and clinically proven screening, cost tests, age appropriateness, wellness exams, maintenance prescriptions. So there's the guidance, Mr. President, that the it needs to be evidence-based. It needs to be something that's clinically proven. And those are pretty well understood as to what those are. you do have to trust your benefit design committee, because some of them, frankly, aren't cost effective. You need to rule those out. I think you can count on the governor to appoint a benefit design committee that will want to make this work, which means you've got to pick the ones that appear to be effective. And, Mr. Chairman, it's pretty well known what those are. We are going to look at expanding the definition a little bit, count some of the primary care visits, like your annual checkup, where that's appropriate, the blood pressure medications, where, for example, the most effective drug is the generic diuretic that costs $4 for a month's supply at any of the big box retailers. Some of those things are preventive, and we would include those. So there are some limits in the bill. They are really calling them to look at the evidence, and I think you can count on the Benefit Design Committee will.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 24, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 24 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 10. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 10, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee, Brucellosis Management Program, an act relating to agriculture and animals. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Geis, Jennings, Johnson, and Vasey, Senator Geis, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Vasey?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, I ask for favorable consideration of Senate File 10. There is a standing committee amendment, number one, if that could be read in at this time.
Senate File 10, standing committee amendment number one, page 4, line 7.
And I would move that standing committee at this time, and to explain the bill and the standing committee amendment, I refer to Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is another bill that your Ag Committee listened to and was brought to you by the Livestock Board dealing with brucellosis. And the purpose of this bill, Mr. Chairman, is to give them another tool to deal with this very important issue that's primarily happening in the western part of our state. And if you look at the bill, what we're talking about is in our language, in our statutes, before we had a testing program, it changes it to a management program. And the management program, and you can see that language on page 1, lines 14. If you go to the next page, you can see that they bring in the language spaying of heifers and other management of the livestock, and then we talk about herd plans and risk assessments. If you go on through the bill, Mr. Chairman, page 2, starting on line 7 and going through the end of that page, we talk about spaying or testing of heifers. Another part of the bill, Mr. Chairman, a major part of the bill that gives the Livestock Board another avenue to try to deal with brucellosis. And the testimony we heard in the committee was that in the western part of the state, what really is causing a lot of the problems, obviously, is the contact between the elk and the cattle. And we can spay the heifers and we can do all these things, but maybe we need to look at ways to separate them out on these forest permits. And the testimony said that there are ways we can do that. We don't want to fence the elk from the cattle. That's pretty hard to do, but we can, in situations that were brought to the committee that talked about a particular calving area where the cattle were in, we could keep the cattle out of that area. Of course, that entire part would be subject to review by the Livestock Board. And Mr. Chairman, that's really what the bill does. Another bill has passed this House that was sponsored by Mr. President, very similar. It didn't get into the management side of this particular program, nor did it get into the try to separate the elk and the cattle. And, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, could we go to the Standing Committee Member Number 1?
Please.
Mr. Chairman, this Standing Committee Member Number 1 takes the budget of $700,000 and $750,000 to $350,000. Your Agriculture Committee, understanding the situation with revenues, trying to be a step up in the Appropriations Committee, you'll see we're not quite a step up when you see the next amendment. But we reduce that from $750,000 to $350,000, and I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Discussion on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Vasey's amendment, Senator Vasey's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 10, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 10 has been passed. Senator Vasey. Senator Nicholas.
You read in the amendment.
Senate File 10, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. Delete the first Senate Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 1, or 10, excuse me. I apologize for that. Ladies and gentlemen, we looked at the, listened to the testimony, looked at the existing budget in the program, which is about $2.1 million. We added $200 million, or we looked at adding $200 million. That'd be a lot of money. What's a zero here, zero there? Pretty soon you got a zero. No. Don't. $200,000. Yeah, we buy all the cows in the state. No, we looked at the total dollars, what we were putting in the supplemental budget, and concluded that it's fair enough to give them the additional tools to work with, but they ought to work with their existing budget. So this amendment takes the all the funding away and leaves them with the, in the regular budget cycle to go through their dollars. I urge your support.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, very reluctantly, I would ask that you vote against this amendment. And it's hard to understand what the Joint Appropriations Committee is going through, dealing with millions all the time. That when it comes to a small program like that, it's hard to deal in thousands. But if the Appropriations Committee was, one of the things that came out of that, though, why I say reluctantly, we do have a large budget there, and the question asked during the meeting was how much of that budget's been spent, and where do we see it, and what should happen. So if this amendment does pass, and we see that there's a need for it, then we could certainly bring it back in the budget bill and the supplemental budget bill, and bring a line item. Addition to that, so vote your conscience.
Senator Vasey.
Mr. Chairman, when we're thinking about this on the bill on page 2, what we're really talking about at the top of that, at line 1, we're talking about those animals within a designated surveillance area. We're not talking about the whole state. It's that risk, you know, the risk assessment, the herd plans within those areas where the brucellosis is prevalent. So, reluctantly, I would ask that you reject this, but.
Senator Nicholas.
You know, folks, when we have committees or agencies wanting more money, we tell them, bring your numbers to us, show us what your present appropriations are, show what you've gotten through the budget. Why do you need the additional money, and where is it going to go, and how is it going to be used? Frankly, we don't get the answers to it. You'd get nothing. And so I challenge the folks, where is the budget? Where is the money going to go? How is it going to be expended? And have you looked at their existing budget to see whether or not they can pay for it with their existing budget? Or you just say that, well, we like this agency, and we think this agency needs more money, and so here it is.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, we just didn't say, well, they want the money, and we gave it to them. There was a lot of testimony, and I'll be glad to provide the chairman of the Appropriations Committee that information. And if, in fact, this is defeated and we can show the need and all of it flows through, we'll talk about it as maybe a supplemental budget amendment.
Further discussion? Further discussion. Are you ready for the question? Thank you. All those in favor of Senator Vasey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it
got to handle that.
Ah, we're still on the second reading amendment. Thank you. I want to rush this. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 10, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Chair is in doubt. All of those in favor, please stand. Those opposed. Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 passes. Back on the bill.
Question on the bill.
Okay, I'll try to do it right this time. Question being called, all those in favor of Senator Vasey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 10, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Senator Cooper.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 141. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File Number 141, sponsored by Senator Johnson, Midwife's Licensure, an act relating to professions and occupations. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 141 do pass. Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment, I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 141, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 8, line 16.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment does two things. First, on the board, there's a special provision in the board in the first 6 years where we don't have the licensed midwives who would normally make up the board, that we've got some people who've had experience as their customers on the board. And then as that shifts, we shift the composition of the board. And the Nurses Association came to us and said they thought it was very important to maintain on this a member who was a licensed nurse midwife, which we do have in this state because we've permitted them for quite a number of years. And the numbers are in little short supply, but they thought there would be plenty of interest in that group. And we agreed with them. So that's what the first part of the amendment, the two page eight references do, is make sure that we keep a licensed nurse midwife on the board. And then, Mr. Chairman, the other on page 10, line 22, frankly, that's a drafting error, and I suspect I'm responsible. I suspect when I was typing it up, I thought one thing and typed another. And what the amendment does is turn it into the standard exemption you see in almost all our practice acts that anybody else licensed under Title 33 practicing within the scope of their license is exempt from this act. So that's all that does. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Standing Committee Amendment urges adoption.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 141, please say aye. Those opposed, say no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
I Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was contacted several years ago by constituents here in Laramie County about a problem of choice. And the choice is, where will their babies be born? Will they be born in a hospital, or can they have home births, have them born at home? And right now, home births are pretty impossible to have. We also know that there are citizens throughout Wyoming that want to have home births. It's just not something for Laramie County, but we've been contacted all over the state, and there is a statewide organization. Why do they want to have home births? Two reasons that can be combined or separate: religion and cultural reasons. And as you well know, you're not going to change anybody's mind on these. If it's a religious reason, it's usually a cultural reason, and that's the way it is for them. I was interested in how many different religions those that want to have their babies born at home followed, who came to me and talked to me about this. And what they're asking here is to have licensed midwives attend their home births. Why are we going after licensed midwives? What's the problems? We have nurse midwives. They're advanced practice nurses. They have their RNBS, and they have a master's degree with an emphasis in obstetrics. The problem is, first of all, our common problem, we don't have that many in Wyoming. And many of those who do live in Wyoming are in obstetric practices, and they won't do home births. They just say no. And, of course, the obstetricians won't either. There were plenty of nurse practitioners and plenty of OBs that were willing to be to do home births, we wouldn't need this bill. Then the problem would be taken care of. And on home births by a licensed midwife, that would always include prenatal and post-birth care for the baby. Now, keep in mind that what we're talking about here is payment. Anybody can go out and help on a home birth, and if they don't ask for a payment, that's fine. They can call themselves a midwife. And another practice that we're having now, because essentially nobody is available, is untrained husbands are helping their wives with the birth of their babies. And when I told that to the nurses that were interested in this, that just terrified them. That just petrified them. We started with Senate File 77, which was a copy of the midwife bill that we had last time. And boy, were there a lot of questions on 77. So in my request, the Labor Committee laid 77 back indefinitely. And we took all of the questions that were asked and created Senate File 141. Thankfully, we had the time. Is a clean bill to take care of all of the problems. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would like to yield the floor to the distinguished senator who wrote Senate File 141, Senator Scott. Okay.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the Senate is going to get tired of me this afternoon. I will try not to trespass on your goodwill and take too much time. Senate File 141 is a full-blown licensure act. And it's a licensure act with a fence. And the fence is that if you do certain things and you're not licensed, you're illegal. You can be prosecuted. The reason for that, Mr. Chairman, is that it became quite evident, listening to the testimony on Senate File 77, not only that the demand was there, that the need was there, that there were people that wanted it, but there were certain people that were filling that need in Wyoming currently who are downright dangerous because they're not well enough trained. There was a prosecution of a midwife here in this county about a couple of years ago, I think, The prosecution was for manslaughter. The information we had was there was a guilty plea to negligent homicide. It involved the death of a baby that was not had an infection, was not properly referred. I've heard since of another case a little earlier where a woman almost bled out due to a home birth where the midwife temporized, wasn't properly trained, didn't realize how fast you can get in trouble with one of those, and they got her to the hospital just in the nick of time. So there's some people that are dangerous that we do not want to allow in practice. And the Medical Society and the Nursing Association came to the committee and raised real objections to the 77, which is just an exemption bill. And they were convincing, Mr. Chairman. So this is a full-blown licensure act. It establishes a board of midwifery. You can see that, page 3 of the bill. And I've got a problem here. This copy of my bill is alternate pages are upside down, which doesn't help my ability to read it. Establishes the board of midwifery, establishes on, you can see it starting on page 3, the requirements for licensure, and let me concentrate on just a few of them. They have to graduate from a midwifery education program accredited by the Midwifery Education Accreditation Council or another agency recognized and accepted accrediting agency. Or is in there to give the board some flexibility if something goes wrong with the accrediting council that there is. We understand there are 10 of those programs in the country now. The testimony from the Medical Society was that they're between they described it as a 2-year-plus program. It includes, and I believe it's been distributed, the curriculum includes training in the key skill of when to refer a patient that gets in trouble. They have to pass a written examination. These are standard. They're put out by the North American Registry of Midwives. The board's given flexibility to provide a different examination if necessary. You need that flexibility in case something goes wrong. They have to complete a practicum, meaning a course of practical experience. Being the requirements that the board establishes, they have to attend a certain specified number. I think the number they were contemplating was 20 or 40, depended on which version they went with. So they've had some practical experience. We give the board authority for a personal interview. And then there's some other requirements there. Item C in page 4, endorse. You can license by endorsement somebody from another state whose requirements are as stringent as ours. Pretty plain vanilla, common provision in our licensure laws. You've got the period of licensure is 2 years. On page 5, they can renew. Important provision, page 6. They can revoke, suspend, or condition the license of a midwife or require the midwife to practice for a time under supervision of a person licensed under the Medical Practice Act, i.e. a physician, a certified nurse midwife, or another midwife as appropriate. If the board finds the midwife has committed any one of the following, you've got your standard list, convicted of a crime, violated the act, abused or neglected patient, failed to refer, item 4, page 6, line 16. Failed to refer a woman or a newborn child in need of care or at risk of needing care beyond the abilities of the midwife to the appropriate health care professional. Very key provision. That's the one that the midwives can get in trouble with if they don't do it. And I think that is a very key provision here. Then a provision for provisional licensure, where they can come in, practice under the supervision of another, until they've had time to go through the complete licensure, somebody doing a practicum, somebody licensed or certified in another state whose requirements are at least as stringent, who's coming in for 30 days or less, either as a locum tenens or to give educational instruction. Then the board membership and organized five-member board. The novel feature here, Mr. Chairman, is normally these boards are populated by people in the profession being licensed. We don't have those to start with. So instead, we authorized for the first 6 years, two of the midwife positions may be filled by women who have experienced the care of a midwife. So we're getting, and these are the people that are really the enthusiasts. They're the customers. They're the ones whose safety is being protected. And we think that's a good way to start the board off. But we'll have also a certified nurse midwife who obviously has had experience with being licensed, and then either a registered nurse or a physician and a member of the public. So you will have people with experience, personal experience with licensure on the board. We have a provision where Attorney General provides legal counsel as necessary to the board and does it without charge until July 1, 2010 to assist in the organization initial rules. ANIs provide the necessary support. After July 1, 2010, they'll be just like every other licensing board and maintain themselves with their own fees. And we did authorize, because we think, Mr. Chairman, there may not be enough midwives to support a full board to start with, we authorized a charge of up to $50 per birth on the customers so that we'd have enough money. Frankly, I tried that idea out in committee during the hearing on Senate File 77, and the proponents, the customers. But, yeah, that would be a reasonable provision. And then there's a penalty provision, high misdemeanor for violating the act, practicing without a license, and an immunity provision. It was a little lengthy. Mr. Chairman, it was copied in part out of a Virginia statute, as were the definitions of midwife and midwifery. But this one I modified some to get the language right. And basically what it says is that, you know, you always have the risk, people being people, that a midwife will mess up and the doctors will have to bail her out and save the life of the mother. You always have that risk. And what this immunity says is if that happens, it's the midwife that's liable for the gross negligence, and the hospital and the doctors are immune. And that gives the medical profession some degree of confidence that if they have to step in and clean up a mess, and I doubt they will, but people being people, it could happen. They're protected. And then if they get a referral and the midwife hasn't met the medical standard of care, which she wouldn't, they're not held liable for that. But they are liable for their own actions. So that's the immunity clause on page 11. Mr. Chairman, that's a quick run through the bill. The fee provision is actually on page 12. I'd be happy to answer any questions. It is a full-blown licensure act. Make no mistake. But I think we've seen enough evidence that you need that to protect the public in this instance, that's justified. I will say to you from the testimony in committee, the Nurses Association had opposed the original bill and supported this one. The Medical Society was against. And their testimony, I think they're going to be against anybody. I think they'd really like to be against anybody that didn't have the full medical degree. But they against anybody that is short of being a full nurse midwife. And we simply can't get enough of those to meet the need. It is a very real need. I think in the absence of this legislation, a number of people in this state, a number of mothers, will continue to go to whatever they can find in the way of midwives, and sooner or later we're going to have another tragedy. So I think this bill is needed both really to protect the public and to meet a very real demand for services that are out there. Be happy to answer any questions.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
I guess the question that I have comes from one who's had a good deal of experience with a very difficult birth in my and my wife's time. And I realize that the birthing process is not just an event. It's a process of prenatal counseling and prenatal care and, you know, a lot of things that lead up to a successful birth. And I guess the question that I have, or at least if you would, not having a lot of knowledge in regard to what midwives do, would you explain to me just a little bit at what point does the midwife engage herself with the mother, and at what length prior to the birth are they engaged in conversation, and how that process leading up to the actual birth event might work? Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that you all realize that a lot of the physicians in the hospitals see the mom for the first time as she walks in labor. So that's a problem that they have. And the midwives, the mothers who want a home birth and want to have a midwife contact the midwives pretty well immediately when they find out that they're going to have a baby, because they want to know that somebody's there. And these ladies have studied about home birthing. They've studied about hospital births. They know their stuff. They know what's going on. So they contact them pretty well closely so that they know they'll have somebody. And the midwives do all the prenatal care. And while they're doing this prenatal care, if they see something with the mother or the baby that tells them that things could go wrong, that's the end. They tell them to go go to the hospital, find an obstetrician, because, and they tell them exactly why, and they just won't give home birth because they're not going to take the chance. So for the most of them, for the great majority of these mothers, birth is normal. And what they tell me, and many of them have, I'm not sick, I'm not hurt. Women have been giving births for millenniums, natural births, and it's a natural process. And if it's going to be a regular natural birth, I want it done in my home because I'm immune to the germs in my home. My baby is immune to those germs also, because I have passed nourishment to my baby. If we go to the hospital, anything's possible. So they're very knowledgeable. They're very experienced. We've talked to a lot of them that have had 4, 5, 6, 7 babies through home birth, and they all said, I'm not saying that there are some that won't, but they've all said that they've done it from the very beginning just so they know somebody will be there.
Senator Von Flader. As I find, I just need a bullseye here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad you found me. On page 12, I don't understand. There's no other point in the bill that talks about charges made by the midwife, cash, the bill for doing it. But yet this page, and I think I know your intent, but the way I read page 12, line 14, the fee for having a baby delivered shall not exceed $50. And I know your intent is not that's the total they can ever charge for the services, but the $50 is going to the board, I assume.
There's Scott.
Mr. Chairman, you have to read that in context with the sentence that precedes it. It says the board may establish fees for licensure, renewal of licenses, late application, provisional licenses, and for having a baby delivered by a midwife. So there's the antecedent. That defines the fee. And then it says the fee, and that refers to the fee that's established by the board for having a baby delivered by a midwife, shall not exceed $50. I think it's clear, if you look at the two sentences together as a unit, that that's the only fee that we're talking about here. It doesn't have anything to do with the professional fee charged by the midwife. I think the way that's construed, it's clear. I would say something in answer to the earlier question on the referral process. The best evidence we had, and the committee looked extensively at this report, evidence-based maternity care, what it is and what it can achieve. Childbirth Connection wrote it, published by the Milbank Memorial Fund, the Performing States Group. They said there that your best evidence showed that somewhere between 5 and 10% of all births will need to be cesarean sections. So the midwife, that's not within the scope of their practice. They get a mother that needs that. They're going to have to refer to medical, and they're trained to do that. Now, I will say that the evidence also says that if you go over 15% of births by cesarean, you are doing more harm than good. The national rate currently is 31.5%. The Wyoming Medicaid rate, and I asked Dr. Sherrard, the health department, what it was, 35% currently. So we've excessively medicalized the obstetric practice, number of reasons for that, defensive medicine, financial incentives, there's a bunch of reasons. But you can see why women are saying, wait a minute, I'm being exposed to an undue risk if I go to the hospital with an obstetrician to start with, of a major operation with all the risks that come with a major operation. You can see why they're going to midwives.
Senator Dockster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to just briefly hear why the nurses weren't on the previous bill and why they're supporting this one. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 77 had a portion in there where somebody could do home study and then go do a practicum with a certified midwife, pass a written test on that, and be certified. And they didn't like that. They wanted a formal education for the midwife. And so when we went into 141, that left, that departed. And now they have to do a 2 to 3 year formal education. And we passed out a copy of the curriculum of the midwifery school in Florida. And then after that, they do the practicum. And when that was put in 141, they said that's acceptable.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions. And I think this good senator, the sponsor, kind of alluded to one. Where is the closest training, and are there other areas? Will this birth be covered under insurance programs? And how about having an obstetrician on the panel or board?
Senator Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I hope I can remember them. I should have written them down. Where can they get the training? Vassar University, Kenmore, Washington, Miami-Dade College, Miami, Florida, Birthing Way College of Midwifery, Portland, Oregon, Birthwise Midwifery School, Bridgeton, Maine, Florida School of Traditional Midwifery, Gainesville, Florida, Maternidad La Luz in El Paso, Texas, Midwives College of Utah, Salt Lake City, National College of Midwifery, Taos, National Midwifery Institute, Bristol, Vermont, and Seattle Midwifery School in Seattle. As far as the insurance goes, that's up to the insurance companies. We can't put that in. So that's just simply, will they cover it? And the third question, somebody? There's room there for a health science person. It can be a nurse. It can be a OB. It can be a physician's assistant. It can be any of those, and that would be up to the governor.
Senator Ross.
Well, for the sponsors, get out your pencils because I have several questions. The first question that I have is, you talked about whether or not the insurance would cover this, and I apparently we don't know really know whether or not, I bet I would venture to guess probably insurance does not cover midwifery. But my question with regards to insurance is there insurance available to the midwives? And should they, or should we not require some sort of insurance requirement in this bill? That's the first question. The second question goes to the immunity. And I think I understand the language, and I think that it is, I understand the intent of it. And I'm assuming that, as the good senator from Natrona County said, it doesn't cover, this immunity provision does not cover the medical physician, nurse, or whatever, for their, they're not immune for their own negligence once they've accepted the patient and they have perhaps their own negligence, but I want to make sure about that. And my question would be, would the sponsors be amenable to some amendment to the immunity provision that says something to the effect that, you know, nothing in this immunity provision pertains to the medical provider from adhering to their standards of care, and, so that we were clear that this immunity provision is specifically protecting those doctors and so forth from the acts of the midwife, but not for their own actions. The third question I have is why on page 12, paragraph B, why that particular paragraph is in the immunity provisions. This particular paragraph deals with prior practice of midwifery does not constitute grounds for the board to deny. Shouldn't that be over in the licensure portion rather than in the immunity portion? Just wondering. That may just be a drafting issue, but I'm just wondering why that's in the immunity provisions. So those are my questions.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'll take the two easy ones, Mr. Chairman, and let my good friend over on the south wall answer the other one. We don't require insurance for anybody in the health science fields in statute, as far as I know. I could be wrong. Is anybody able to educate me? So no reason to require it here. And on 12B, that's there because staff put it there. And if it should be changed and moved somewhere else, we're very open to an amendment. And my good friend, you got the immunity.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me answer the 12B. That's probably a draft. You can probably construe that a drafting error. I'm sure that one is my fault. And the reason it's there is that's where it was in the Virginia statute that I was using in part as a model. It probably should be elsewhere. It is important because some of the people who will qualify for licensure, particularly the ones from Colorado, have done some practice in Wyoming, even though it was illegal. And we don't want to exclude them. They're perfectly good practitioners if they've been adequately trained. Frankly, some of these people, Mr. Chairman, see themselves on a mission. They believe in natural childbirth, and they've been willing to take some chances to provide it to parents that really want it. We didn't think, and Virginia didn't think, that was a good idea to deny them licensure. So that's why it's here. Doesn't matter whether you put it in the immunity thing or somewhere else. We could perfectly well move it to somewhere else if you desired. But if it's a drafting error, it's clearly mine, not the LSO's. Second, on the immunity, let's be very precise here. The immunity, when they're dealing with a circumstance where there was negligence on the part of the midwife, and they got a mess, the hospital or person licensed in the medical practice act, nurse, etc., none of them shall be liable for care provided to the woman or the newborn child subsequent to care provided by a midwife whose care was negligent, etc. So if they clean up a mess, they are immune. No two ways about it. And the reason for that is the practice of the trial bar, in this case, cases like this, of suing everybody they can think of, whether or not they really were negligent themselves. And you want to have an absolute immunity there where the real negligence was in the part of the earlier party, the midwife. You want to have a absolute immunity so that the case can be dismissed. Because otherwise, these medical practice cases can be horrendously expensive. And that expense, you know, we had a case here, I believe it was in this county, a few years ago, where the doctors won. But it was radiology, I understand. But the information we got was that the cost of the defense was $430,000. And you need to have, so that the medical profession will have confidence in dealing with one of these cases, where you know there's been negligence, where there's going to be suing, you need to have an absolute immunity provision so they'd be willing to take on and provide the care that's needed, and so that they aren't running great risks by having licensed midwives in the community. That's why that one's written the way it is. On the other, where there's been a referral, they're not liable for the failure of the midwife to meet the standard of care, but they are liable for their own actions. And an amendment to clarify that, if you think it's necessary, would be perfectly reasonable. But in the first case, I think that the full immunity is necessary given the way the practices are with the trial bar. Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers those questions.
Thank you. Senator Scott. Yeah, no, Senator Ross. Sorry. There's so many, the name is close.
Well, and I hate to belabor this point, but I don't believe that you answered my question. I don't believe the language that you quoted. I believe that language says that they're not liable for the negligence that was created by the midwife. My question is, and I thought you said in the presentation of the bill that they would still be responsible if they made their own negligent mistake. Now, what I've heard you say here just now is that, no, they have a complete bar. And I don't know why we would do that. We don't provide any immunity for anybody necessarily for their own negligent acts. I don't have immunity as an attorney. Other doctors in their practice or nurses or whatever else, they don't have immunity. So I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to fully understand what this language says, because I read this, when I read it first off, I read it to say that the doctor who takes on, there's a mess. We know that the midwife messed up. They were negligent, we already said, or they were grossly negligent or willful and wanton. They have a mess on their hands. They're not responsible. That provider shouldn't be responsible for the acts of the midwife. But if they take on a case and they do something themselves that was negligent, are we going to give them immunity for that, for their own negligence? If so, I think that that's not clear in this language. And if that's the intent of this, then, I think that, that's why I asked, would the sponsors of this legislation be amenable to an amendment that says that a physician or whatever must still follow their own standard of care once they've taken on the case? They could have done something that I don't think we should hold them responsible for the midwife, but I think we should still hold them responsible for their own actions if it was negligent.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and we need to be very clear because you've got two different circumstances. You've got the more common circumstance where the midwife has referred somebody that needs to be referred. That's going to happen all the time. And there, the intent, and I think the language actually is fairly clear, that the doctor is not responsible for the failure of the midwife to meet any standard of care which the doctor or anybody else is subject to. That's the midwife's problem, and frankly, their standards are going to be different from those for the medical community, and they should be, because the standard of care that's been established is one of the major problems in obstetric practice. The standard of care calls for unnecessary practices and is positively harmful. But that's a different problem for a different day. In that circumstance, which will be the common one, the doctors are perfectly liable. They make a mistake. They're negligent. There's no question they're liable. Or the hospital or anybody else is liable. The absolute immunity, and it is intended, Mr. Chairman, to be an absolute immunity. And you look at it, the sentence starts on line 13, no hospital, and then you get a list of the people that may be involved, shall be liable for care provided to a woman or a newborn child subsequent to the care provided by a midwife whose care was negligent, etc. And that's there. You can say theoretically, well, if they do something negligent themselves, they ought to be held liable. And they will be held accountable by the Board of Medicine and whatnot, but they won't be legally liable. And the reason for that is the practice of the trial bar in searching for a deep pocket where they sue everybody. And these things are extraordinarily expensive. And, Mr. Chairman, what happens is, because there was a bad outcome, and the study that there was done, follow-up on the Harvard Medical Practice Study, shows that most of the malpractice cases, you where there's a bad outcome, you can get a settlement just because it was a bad outcome. But having to do with negligence. And what happens is big settlements get extorted, and I use that word intentionally, on the operation of our legal system. You need to provide that absolute immunity. Otherwise, you're asking the doctors to get sued if they ever... Now, hopefully they won't ever have to, but you can't guarantee that that won't happen because the midwives are people, too. And I never yet met any person, Mr. Chairman, myself included, who was perfect. And there's always a risk something will go wrong.
Thank you. Senator Vasey.
Mr. Chairman, before we get into, go back into the argument of liability and things like this, the reason I'm on this bill is because there's a small group of people that believe that they can be very well served by their home birth. The reason I signed on is they didn't come to me very forceful, but they were interested in it. I guess one of the reasons I'm on it is because when I look at their children, they're well-loved, well-taken care of. I mean, they believe that when you have a child that you are responsible for that child for his duration of the latitude. That's why I'm on it, and I think we need to get back to that argument and that because these people truly... The other reason is that the people in the Carbon County that are there that are interested in this, their choice is either go to Colorado to do this legally or someplace else. And I would say that you all have been, or most of you all have been down I-80, and you put a mother's life much more in danger going down that highway than you do with a midwife. The other thing, I think the people that I know that are interested in this would be appalled at any argument over legal and immunity. They live their lives. They pay their own bills. They pay with cash. So I'd hope that we'd get back to serving that group that we're originally talking about.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, I belabor the points made by my colleague from Laramie County, who the issues and the problems with the immunity language have huge constitutional issues and will, so I assume, deal with on amendments. But let me say this with respect to the trial bar. My colleague from Natrona County does not state accurately what the standard and practice of the trial bar in Wyoming is. In Wyoming, and I don't know what Harvard does other places, but in Wyoming, you cannot and should not file a lawsuit in Wyoming until and after you have an expert already engaged who has provided an opinion in the area of expertise that there is the care fell below the standard of care required of that physician. If you don't have that, and you don't get it in a short time after you file it immediately, the case will be dismissed. And if you look at the statistics in Wyoming, juries have been very, they like their doctors, and you won't even find a jury verdict against a doctor in the last course of the last 10 years. But I could submit to you, and I'm familiar with the standard of care for trial bars. In this state, we don't do that. You only file a case after you've got a doctor who has practices in that area of expertise and gives you an opinion that beyond a reasonable degree of medical probability that there was negligence. And if you don't have that, your case is going to get dismissed, not with a lot of money, but in pretty short order in about 3 or 4 months. And the defense lawyers know how to defend. They're competent at doing that. And the courts are quite disciplined at making sure that lawyers do not file those kinds of cases. So you may not like your members of the trial bar, but that is not an accurate statement of our standard of care in Wyoming for our lawyers any more than you could say that for doctors or anyone else. We have a very good, high-quality bar, and we insist and demand that they get these opinions first. And if you have statute of limitations issues where you have to file it, and you might actually go out and name additional people in short order, you better go out and get your experts and line them up. And if you don't have it, you're going to have your case dismissed almost immediately.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to thank my good friend and co-sponsor from the Mother County. This bill, we will remember, is based on the requests and the needs of those of our citizens who want home birth for cultural and religious and personal reasons. And I would like to keep it to that. We also in the legislature have a system of amendments that we can bring before this body in the second and third readings if there's questions on a section of this statute. I feel that the statute, except maybe in this spot, and that's a big capital maybe, is a good statute, and it's a needed statute. And the people who want this statute are listening on the web as we talk about it because they have a network and they talk to each other. I would ask that we pass this with a recommend do pass through the Committee of the Whole, and if people have problems, my good friends, with this bill in areas, specific areas, please come forward with amendments, and amendments take a really good bill, and they make it better. Thank you.
Okay. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 141, say aye. Those opposed, say no. The bill has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Sorry. I just got to keep going, sign. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 27. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File Number 27, sponsored by Senator Case, Outdoor Lighting, an act relating to public health and safety. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Elections Political Subdivisions, that reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott. No, Senator Cooper, Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, we got a late start today, and we've worked pretty hard, and I know there's some other bills. This one will take a little while. I would ask that if there's no objection from the body that we lay this bill back till tomorrow. I talked to the majority floor leader about this. There's no maneuvering either way, and just think it'd be better off tomorrow. I will tell you that that really bright star in the western sky is the planet Venus. It's extraordinarily bright right now. You should enjoy that. It's so bright that no matter how much outdoor lighting you have right now, you can witness that star. That's not true of everything in our night sky. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, there's no objection on my part, and if I might have just a brief privilege of the floor, I'm going to say that we're going to do one more bill.
The next bill for our consideration is... Okay, I do. Okay. Our expert on Masons has... Absent objections, Senate File 27 is laid back at the pleasure of the Majority Floor Leader. Is that acceptable, Madam Chief Clerk? Thank you.
That's acceptable.
Next bill for our consideration is Senate Joint Resolution 5. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate Joint Resolution 5, sponsored by Senator Bebout, Hydraulic Fracturing, a joint resolution requesting Congress to preserve the exemption of hydraulic fracturing in the Safe Drinking Water Act and to not pass any future legislation which would remove the exemption.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
2 minutes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. It reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Martin. No, Senator Larson. Senator Larson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate Joint Resolution 5, and that further reading of the bill be dispensed with. Mr. Chairman, there is a Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate Joint Resolution 5, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 13.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and to explain both the bill and the amendment, I'd like to call on Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hydraulic fracturing, I thought what I might do with this body is give you a brief explanation of really what we're talking about here. And if you're familiar, and most of you are, with the drilling of a well, when you start your drilling procedure, you drill what's called surface casing. And the depth of your surface casing is dictated by the Oil and Gas Commission and or the BLM or both. And, of course, the purpose of your surface casing as you drill down is to be sure that the drilling will not interfere or cause any damage to those shallow aquifers. A lot of them provide water to communities and homes around that are in that same aquifer. After you've drilled the surface casing and ran your pipe, then you come in and cement that surface casing. And you cement the casing with a certified cementer, and you return the cement to the surface so you know that your casing has been set to the depth required by the rules implemented by the appropriate people, and you cemented that casing in place clear to the surface so you know have a good bond so you know you're protecting your surface water. At that point in time, you go into that cemented surface casing and drill to a depth. Now, some holes will set intermediate casing, which is another string of pipe that's set to protect the formations and different things that might occur in the well. Or you go to your, you drill the hole to your total depth. And if you drill to your hole to your total depth, either way, you will once again set casing. And when you set that casing, you will cement the casing in place as well. And all this is followed by bond logs to ensure that you have a good cement job so that the casing and everything and the formations around it are protected because you have cemented the casing in place. Once this is all done, you have your bond log, then you can proceed to try to complete the well. And you will drill out your cement in that well. Then you will go in and through the logs that you've run, you will decide which area to perforate. You perforate where you think the reservoir is that will contain the hydrocarbon. So you perforate that particular part in the well, and then you will be able to determine if you want to produce that well or not based on your results and some things you might see and the logs. In a lot of places in our state and in the Rockies, at that point in time, on your completion procedure, which is where you want to put the well into production, you have to hydraulically fracture that well. And what that means is that in this particular formation, the terminology used in our industry is it's a tight formation. But just under layman's terms, it means that the porosity and the way that formation is made up, it will now not allow the hydrocarbon to get into the bore of the well to be produced to the surface. So even though you have a formation that contains hydrocarbons in production quantities, you're not able to get that hydrocarbon to the surface, mostly gas, because the formation will not allow it to flow freely to the wellbore. So over the years, and particularly in the last 15, 20 years, they've developed this technique of hydraulic fracturing. And what that is, and you have a special group of people come out, an independent contractor, if you will, that provides that service. And what they do is they pump into that formation, and just to, once again, simplify it, small marbles that they, under pressure, put into the formation to attempt to open the formation. And that process works. And they open the formation up by putting pressure in these little marbles, or we call them balls, but you put that in there, and it opens the formation up in the sand, and the formation allows the hydrocarbon to come to the wellbore and be produced. That's what hydraulic fracturing does. You have the protection of the surface casing and the cementing to protect surface waters. You have the protection of the intermediate casing string that's cemented and or the long string that's cemented in place. And that's all of the protection that's provided by the operator in producing that well. The purpose of Senate Joint Resolution 5, Mr. Chairman, is when the Safe Drinking Water Act was passed, and I'm not sure when it was passed, but since its enactment, the Environmental Protection Agency has never interpreted hydraulic fracturing as constituting underground injection under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And since it's not under the Safe Drinking Water Act, they're able to proceed and do what they do with local controls, the BLM, the Oil and Gas Commission overseeing this procedure. And if you look at the joint resolution, there's a lot of things in there that would point to the fact that this, in fact, is very safe. It's a procedure that's been looked at many, many times by many, many different people. And to my knowledge, they have not come up with anything that would justify changing it or exempting it from that particular part of the Safe Drinking Water Act. In fact, in 2004, and as I explained the joint resolution, the EPA published a final report summarizing a study to evaluate the potential threat of underground sources of drinking water from hydraulic fracturing and found that the injection of hydraulic fracturing into CBM wells poses minimal threats. It goes on to say on page 2, line 17, Congress in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 explicitly exempted hydraulic fracturing. The IOGCC, which is the independent oil and gas producing governments that Wyoming is a member of, has done a survey, and I will tell you that most of the language here has come from their resolution that Wyoming, Montana, and a number of states participate with to show you the importance they think of fracturing and why it does not submit a threat to anybody. The other thing, if you look on page 3, and specifically that I like, is that traditionally the issue of hydraulic fracturing has been left up to the states. If you want to put it under the Safe Drinking Water Act, it would not be left up to the states. You further go on, and page 4, once again, there's just more information that talks about this procedure is safe. The way we do it has been tested over and over and over. It poses no threat. Therefore, there's no reason to remove the exemption. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd like to get into the first Standing Committee Amendment number 1, and explain that real quick-like, and if there's any question, answer them. Otherwise, ask for the question on it. And if you look at the standing committee member number one, the first two items are just some cleanup because we had SWDA, and it's not the Safe Water Drinking Act, it's the Safe Drinking Water Act. The next part of it, Mr. Chairman, starting on lines 8, going through lines 19, I just wanted the body to understand from a Department of Energy study the impact if in fact, we went under the underground injection control program. You can see the dollars amounts there, the amount of gas, et cetera, that would cost our country. And I asked a question in committee, if in fact we eliminated hydraulic fracturing from this exemption, what that would do to the Wyoming drilling in terms of our gas production. 95%, maybe 80 to 95%, somewhere in that range of our wells have this method of treatment for their completions. So essentially, the Jonah Field, the Pinedale Anticline, the Wamsutter area, a lot of areas in our state would not be able to produce any hydrocarbons because they could not use hydraulic fracturing. So from that standpoint, there's a huge impact to the state. But forget that for a moment. Hydraulic fracturing is safe, and the exemption has been warranted and proven over many times. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for the question on Standing Committee Member Number 1 if there are no other questions.
Any questions on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1? Having heard the question called, all those in favor of Senator Larson's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File to Senate Joint Resolution 5, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment is passed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Then the entire reason for the joint resolution, Mr. Chairman, is on page 5 where we say, the Wyoming State Legislature hereby declares its support for maintaining the exemption of hydraulic fracturing for the provisions of the Safe Water Drinking Act and so on and so forth. And I think the reason it's so important is because within the Rockies and the other states within the Rockies that produce hydrocarbons, specifically natural gas, use hydraulic fracturing because they have tight gas reservoirs as well. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for your favorable consideration of this Senate joint resolution.
You want to do something about the Committee of the Whole Resolution Number 1, Senator Bebout?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that that be read in.
Senate Joint Resolution 5, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, lines 1 through 6.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate Joint Resolution 5. And ladies and gentlemen, what this does, if you look at page 2, the top of the page, I get very nervous when we talk about how different people read an 11th Circuit Court of Appeals rule or decision, and so I just remove that from the joint resolution.
Any discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1? Hearing none. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate Joint Resolution 5, please say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Committee of the Whole Resolution Number 1 has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Larson?
Chairman, I feel I should explain my vote in committee. I did vote no. I'm in complete agreement with all of the subject matter. I don't like joint resolutions to Congress, period. That's the only genesis of the no vote. I do support the concept and think it's probably a good idea, but I'm not wild about sending joint resolutions so that our Congress people can open that up and see, gee, what did the Wyoming legislature send me today every morning? So that's the only reason to no vote.
Senator Massey, I was just hunting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsors of the resolution. And by the way, that was a very good explanation. I didn't understand it until I heard that. But I know that they've been having some problems as a result of oil and gas development up near Clark, Wyoming, north of Cody. And I don't know if that's a result of fracturing or not, but as I was hearing the description, that came to me. So I thought I would just simply raise the question to see if it has any pertinence to this resolution.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, I'll attempt to answer that, and I will definitely get more information, too, to provide to my colleague from Albany County. As I understand what happened in Clark, it was a blowout, and all of you are familiar with the blowout. It's where, for whatever reason, the pressure from the reservoirs below exceed the mud in the hole to hold it down, and it erupts like a volcano, if you will. And when that happened, of course, it created a mess. I mean, it blew out all over the formation. So that really had nothing to do with fracturing, in the sense that anything damaged by the fracturing would have occurred. I don't know whether that happened while they were drilling the well and lost control of the well. I'm not sure in the timing, but I could get that information and share that with you tomorrow.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I wish the sponsor would help me out here, because I see we're in this that the EPA says that it's, that it's fine and that it's exempt. And Congress has stated, has specifically exempted it. And the IOGCC likes it and everything. I haven't heard anywhere in the bill nor in the explanation who doesn't like it. And so, frankly, why is this joint resolution necessary?
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, there again, just on people representing to me and talking about it, I think there's been a move in Congress under the new administration to remove that exemption. And I think it's important that because of the importance of this and the fact that we haven't seen any data that shows it to be otherwise, that we should let people know our positions on it, that we don't think it should be removed. So it's sort of a preemptive step, if you will, being proactive to say, here's where Wyoming is, here's what we think about this, here's why, and please consider our position.
Senator Vasey.
And I appreciate the good chairman of Minerals. He's been consistent with his resolution, but I think this one goes a little farther. I think, there's other states that do this around Colorado, but I think one of the major finds, not a find, is the Bakken shale play in North Dakota. Now, the Williston Basin has that oil, and there's people in this room that could probably educate me very much on that, but I really do believe that's a huge play. It would provide American energy, American oil, and without fracturing, I don't think that could be developed. And the reason they're now in that Bakken shale is the fact that with new technology, new ways to do this, now they can retrieve that oil. So it's not only the state; it's a regional thing, and we have got to get serious about developing our own energy, whether it's this or everything else, because quite frankly, we're always going to be dependent on something else, but we could go a long ways to be self, take care of our own selves.
Further discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that to do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate Joint Resolution 5, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate Joint Resolution has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried.
Well, that was supposed to be in a short 5-minute session.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 24, do pass amended. Senate File 10, do pass amended. Senate File 141, do pass amended. Senate File 27, laid back. And Senate Joint Resolution 5, do pass amended. Senator Johnson, Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye. Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Messages from the House.
February the 3rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 199. Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, The House adopted the Committee of the Whole report, failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Joint Resolution 15, Education Funding Amendments, ayes 12, noes 47, excused 1. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Announcements. Senator Vasey.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet within 5 minutes upon adjournment in S-15 to discuss House Bill 16, engrossed the cottage food industry, and House Bill 12, engrossed brand inspection fees.
Senator Von Playfield.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow, 10 minutes after adjournment, in S-13 to review House Bill 43, engrossed military department leasing fees, House Bill 46, engrossed National Guard Medical Professional Retention Program, House Bill 2, engrossed steel, street rods and custom vehicles, and Senate File 143, marking structures that obstruct flight.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the committee room to be Senate Joint Resolution 3, Freedom of Choice in Health Care, and Senate File 129, Juvenile Justice Amendments, and that's with a caveat that if the amendments can be successfully worked out and if some of the other issues are dealt with, otherwise we will not take that up. So that one's contingent.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Senate Appropriations Committee number 2 will meet upon adjournment at NS-13 to consider the following bill: Senate File 119, Public Transportation Funding; Senate File 66, Medicaid Foot Care; Senate File 93, Oral Health Initiative. A reminder that the JAC will meet tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to go over the language of the budget bill, and that'll be in room 204. Then on adjournment tomorrow in room 204, the Senate Appropriations will be meet to consider Senate File 39, Child Health Insurance Program; Senate File 87, Wolf Brucellosis Testing; and Senate File 99, Career and Technical Training Grants. Thank you.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow, 30 minutes after the noon recess, and S-18 to discuss House Bill 1112, Engrossed Workforce Housing Program; House Bill 182, Low Profit Liability Companies; and House Bill 59, Engrossed Liquor License for Golf Clubs.
Senator Ross, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. To consider the following bills: House Bill 80, Engrossed Sequestration Site Unitization, which is a continuation from our previous meeting, and Senate File 145, Hospital and Healthcare Districts, Services to Providers. We will shift the order in which they're listed on the notice to accommodate the Chairman of Appropriations, so we'll take up Senate File 145 first and then continue our work on House Bill 80.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Rules and Procedures Committee will meet immediately after adjournment this evening for a brief period of time in the President's office. Also, the group that had planned their social event at the establishment under question this afternoon wants you to know that that event is still going to occur in the place and at the time previously announced. So. Thank you, Mr. President.
You've heard the motion that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Wednesday, February 4th. All in favor say aye. Those opposed, no. Senate is adjourned.